This is part two of national security and individual freedom. As we've stated before, it's a transcription of a speech given by John Lloyd O'Brien at Harvard in April of 1955. Any background noises you hear by the birds are intended for the use of our audience. No rebroadcast, no. I mean, I just want to lay something down, okay? If you're looking for somebody that you consider anointed because they're professorial, you know, or they scratch a little chin strip there or snap their suspenders, it ain't happening here, okay? I'm just like you are. And if you don't like that, then don't listen, okay? But in the meantime, I like birds. And the birds are outside the window. It's feeding time. And who knows what's going to happen. Why do I like birds? Excuse the pun, because they ground us. They can fly. We can't. All right, before we get back into the text of the first half of the speech, O'Brien gets it and doesn't mind talking about it with regard to worrying about government, whether it's Republican or democratically run, whatever. He's just concerned about the machine itself, the corporation, and what it will do to those who are not considered good patriots. The time period between the end of World War II, and I guess if you have to look for demarcation points, I guess Vietnam, I don't know. It was interesting because a lot of stuff was done behind the scenes to start to morph this country, as other countries are being morphed, into alignment with the one world government, which will appear to be a very good thing, but in the end will be the poison apple. You bite into it, and you're dead. And that's what's going to happen to us. So for his part, I can understand O'Brien not getting that it's just not the Soviet Union who's up to all these nasty things like propaganda, like mine ops. I mean, let's face it. It was happening here, too. You know, the United States may have won World War II, maybe. But almost like the biblical account of the exorcism of demons from human beings, they invested a flock, if you remember, and then the flock had to be driven over a cliff to finally kill the demons. Or even in the movie Exorcism, the priest that was not prepared to do it exorcised the demon from the child, and it invested him, and he flung himself down the stairs in Georgetown to make sure the demon went down with him. So it is with the United States. I mean, let's remember something. I mean, after the war was over, nobody was paying attention. Understandably, people were trying to get their lives right, get back to some kind of economic, not prosperity necessarily, just, you know, a life without deprivation. And it wasn't that way for everyone across the board, let's face it, and it still isn't to this day. But they weren't concerned with what was going on, and that was the time when our own government, I mean, I'm not blaming anybody from the outside. I'm not blaming Israel or Jews or commies or Russians. Forget it. Right here, we had enough people dedicated to moving our country away from whatever it was supposed to be and clearly wasn't, to fit into a world government. And, you know, I look at it this way. There were three laboratories. One was in Europe, and that was the socialism laboratory. One was in the United States, and that was the capitalistic laboratory. Now, you can argue that capitalism was around since, what, the 14th, 15th century? I guess. But as it's seen by people in stark realities, black and white, United States capitalism, Europe socialism, and, if you will, beyond the Urals, I guess Russia and most of Southeast Asia being communist in whatever form. You know, I don't care, Maoism, yeah, fine, all right, whatever. Here's the thing, too. And, I mean, people want to split hairs about communism and all. Look, Here's what we're going to, totalitarianism, all right? Complete control by the state. Call it whatever you want. I don't care. It's the methods to which we get there. And one of the things that's really kind of tricky is socialism, because now, and for the last 10 years or so and beyond now, children, young people coming up through the education system from public school, private school, I don't care, into college, like socialism because it sounds like it's a fair deal, and that's what it's supposed to sound like. But consider that Adolf Hitler considered himself a socialist, that Mao considered himself a socialist, and that Uncle Joe considered himself a socialist, and see where it led to. To me, all socialism is a bait and switch on your way to communism and on your way to totalitarianism. That's the bottom line. The state is everything. Forget about it. All right. I also find it interesting, in the 50s, if you wish, there's an excellent book by Renee Wurmser called Foundations, Their Power and Influence. Wurmser was a counsel to one of the two committees, Reese and Cox, that were trying to get to the bottom of what was going on in the United States and what kind of power did the robber baron families wield. Now, when we're talking about robber barons, I mean, you can find a list of them if you wish. Go take a look. But we're talking about Rockefeller and Carnegie, Vanderbilt, Morgan, Astor, and so many others who, I mean, it's like what Mussolini said about corporate fascism. You know, that seemed like a stupid thing to say. Corporate fascism, what? They're just companies. You know, they're business people. No, they're not. And they're the ones that run this country, you know, at this very moment. And when almost all was lost, if not all was lost, in fact, was during the 50s. And Wurmser writes about how he was watching the robber baron families, the foundations, gaining more and more strength, using corporations as their insulation and means of prosperity, but also by doing good things on the outside so that they looked like they were really nice people. I mean, who could be that much of a bastard without doing something good? I mean, even the mafia gave to the local churches. So when we talk about the robber barons, that's what we're talking about. They bought out government. They long before that had bought out media. They still do to this day. And there's help from abroad as well. We were not in this alone. Europe, as the Holy Roman Empire, never really went underground, just had to, like, change things, have others protect it, like the British Empire and then the United States at the turn of the 19th into the 20th century, which you could argue we've been fighting ever since. And going back to that analogy of the United States being invested by the spirit of Nazism, I have no doubt that that took place. I mean, while we're supposedly fighting the bad old communists, we needed a new enemy after the Nazis. Well, we brought the Nazis over here and used whatever we could from them. And in turn, this country has turned fascist. There's a book by Leonard Peikoff entitled The Ominous Parallels, The End of Freedom in America, written in 1981, and it also calls exactly what's going to take place. Now, Peikoff is an exponent of the Ayn Rand school of objectivism. I don't care. And he doesn't believe in religion, and I get that. But what he says about the things that in the United States that lent itself to becoming exactly what we hated is in that book. And I'm going to post the audio I have of that. I think it's 13 or 14 parts. If you can go out and read the book, read the book. I mean, there's a lot talked about religion and philosophy and all this other stuff. But the point of the matter is we look back at Nazism as created by a bunch of cement heads and bigots. And so be it. But the point was, Germany was the epitome of the arts at that time before it went down the tubes. This wasn't a country of hooligans from day one. I mean, this was a country looked up to as being, like I said, at the zenith of a number of things, and it went so abysmally fascist. How did that happen? How could you work up that kind of sentiment in people? And so that's an analysis of it, and that's Peikoff's The Ominous Parallels. Well, what's happening here is the same thing. Now, I don't call myself a Christian. I do believe in the Bible. You know, Christianity is another thing that got infiltrated. But then I realized, you know, the question was always asked, as how in the world Hitler got such traction, and why didn't the moral institutions like Christianity rise up against him? And because of what's happened recently in this country, I realized. And that is because the churches were behind him. I mean, how evangelical Christians can find anything in that ass clown called Trump to be Christian, I have no idea. Except they align themselves with the Republican Party, and anything the Republican Party throws out there, they're behind. When Christians should not be behind anything, it's none of our business. But that's how it goes. So in this country, you know, do I think that Trump really is the drunken uncle that he portrays himself to be? No. He's playing a role, and he'll be reelected no matter what. And the history books one day will write about how this country went wrong and it was because of Trump's administration, whatever. You know, they take a fall, they don't care. They're taken care of while they live for their time on earth. So the thing is that just like in the changeover into Nazi Germany from the Weimar Republic or whatever, same thing's happening here. Now we got evangelical churches backing this guy because he's like somebody what? Moral? Spiritual? Come on, will you? I mean, that guy would be great to hang around with in bars, but, you know, come on. And like I said, it's a role. He must be laughing his butt off. I keep thinking this is all one big situation comedy, you know what I mean? Where it's like, okay, we were only fooling around, you know, it's a skit, you know. But no, it's not. And we're going to continue this. And it's not going to end well for us in the U.S. So getting back now to the text, and my bloviating is finished with for now. Understand that the 50s, in the mid-50s when this speech was given, I cannot fault O'Brien for not understanding he's being propagandized that, you know, the Soviet Union with horns and stuff. And I want to mention one thing, which I said I wouldn't, and that is, I mean, at this time, I mean, I was watching TV, and you would see these, I wouldn't say commercials, but wherever you flip through the channels, and they would like show this like black hammer and sickle, you know, in a cartoonographic thing, spreading across Europe and into the United States, and this black paint coming all over everything, and Khrushchev, you know, with his antics, banging his shoe on the table at the UN. And I just want to say one thing. Khrushchev is probably the first heavy metal band ever. I mean, truthfully, if some clever bunch of guys or girls and or could create a soundtrack to Khrushchev's antics, I'm telling you, man, it would fit. It would fit. So, so Nikki was doing his thing, and they had us scared. And in October of 62, when we had the missile crisis that lasted more or less for about a month, I mean, you know, we, as kids, I mean, I'm like, what? I'm in the fifth grade. I'm thinking, okay, this is it, man. All hell's breaking loose. And we expected it. And, of course, it didn't. Do I think it was scripted? Yes, I do, at least to some degree. But that's the kind of thing that was going on. I mean, it was the fear-mongering like we have today with Islam. You know, I mean, like, so, you know, what do you expect? I mean, you got to have an enemy. You got to have group hate. You know, Orwell nailed it. Got to have somebody to hate. Right now, it's Islam. You know, now maybe the Russians are coming back into that fold. But that's what America feeds on. Bad guys, villains, people. And we go off and fight again and again and again. And as I said before, if the United States was a person, that person would be in jail as a psychopath, okay? Anybody that fights that much, it's worse than Randall McMurphy in Cuckoo's Nest. So this was the time, and as I said before, foundations for Rene Wormser. Take a look at it, because that's when the last statesmen were drained out of our federal representatives, Congress, both houses. And that's it. It was pretty much, you know, flipped a sign saying closed. It's all over with. And Wormser was dismayed at the fact that they could not get into the intentions of the foundations, most notably the Rockefeller and Carnegie. And they had their little boy, their little whore, Wayne Hayes, run interference in these committees. They had to put somebody in there that would just obfuscate and instigate and aggravate the situation, and they did it successfully. And that's when everything pretty much went south. So let's get back to the speech, John Lord O'Brien in Harvard in April of 1955. Until recently, the finest achievement of the Americans in terms of progress has been their faith in a common humanity and the deliberate promotion of mutual respect and of reasoned toleration. It has taken generations of patient effort to create this moral tradition, yet, as Chief Justice Warren has pointed out, it is now in serious danger. Although the Canadian government issued the report of the Royal Commission to investigate the Soviet spying in June 1946, and startled the whole world, it was not until several years afterward, when admitted traitors testified before the Congressional Committee, that the Americans began to realize the character and extent of the Soviet secret activities in this country. From that time to the present, however, one disclosure after another has been educating the American public to a full realization of the danger which had threatened them. It is not too much to say that all sections of the country have now become thoroughly alerted to the peril. And this is a historical fact of first-rate importance. In addition to providing an education on Soviet activities, these same exposures of the practices and propaganda of the Soviet government have revealed to all Americans the utterly brutal, amoral, and repellent nature of its ideology. The growing realization of the antagonism of Soviet ideology toward the religious and the ethical principles valued by the Western world has aroused and unified American public opinion more than any other single cause. This is now the most powerful and widespread influence combating communism in America. The sudden access of fear caused by the exposure of Russian activities provoked at first a reaction akin to panic, which in turn evoked from the executive and from Congress a series of drastic measures aimed at the suppression of subversive activities and at the same time having an appreciable effect upon the constitutional guarantees of the right to think and speak freely, and, equally important, the right to criticize freely. No one can deny or minimize the difficulty of balancing the necessity for national security and the traditional rights of the free citizen. This problem, in its multiform aspects, has plagued and bedeviled all branches of government, including the courts, and is still without a satisfactory solution. Because it involves such incommensurable values, as well as qualities of judgment, the necessity for preserving our internal security is now the most significant of the many areas involving the problem of reconciliation between national safety and individual freedom. For this reason, governmental activities require special scrutiny from the viewpoint of the constitutional guarantees. Review of the policies established by the Congress and the executive for the purpose of combating subversive activities and influences will demonstrate, I think, that in reality we have been establishing something like a new system of preventative law applicable to the field of ideas and essentially different from traditional American procedures. This startling fact has been obscured by the discussion of particular instances of injustice and seemingly has escaped notice of even political scientists. Until these new administrative policies were adopted, this nation had adhered firmly to the traditional Anglo-American method of combating activities of an antisocial character. Under that policy, no direct attempt was made by law to prevent the wrongful act before it was committed, other than by warning the citizenry, generally, of what consequences would be. Once the wrongful act had actually been committed, its author and only the author was punished by the state. This elementary principle had long been embodied also in civil procedures. And there's a footnote to this. This was part of a declining decision in the libelous matter of Patterson versus Colorado, 1907. And we're going to quote something here from A History of English Law, Volume 6, published in 1924. In 1694, the House of Commons, relying upon a strong statement of policy, drafted, it is said, by John Locke, prevailed upon the House of Lords to let the Licensing Acts die without extension. Since 1694, there have been no prior censorship measures on the British statute books. Right, that is the end of the end note quote. Back to O'Brien. The advantage of this age-long legal system lay in the relatively precise selection that was made centering upon the wrongdoer, leaving the rest of the community free from direct governmental action. By holding up as examples those who were found guilty, a form of prevention was achieved without premature state interference. Because of the peculiar sanctity of individual freedom in a democratic society, governmental interference with the expression of thought has usually been entirely forbidden, whether that interference be preventative or punitive in character. For, and this is a quote, law exists expressly to preserve the freedom of the spirit and the moral activity of the enlightened intelligence, and there is no freedom beyond the law. That's the end of the quote, and that comes from the court case Communications Commission versus Dowds. And don't have a year here. All right, back to O'Brien. In the past, nothing has more clearly differentiated the basic principles of free government from those of despotism and the police state than adherence to this Anglo-American belief in the transcendent importance of law and the refusal to countenance criminal prosecution based only upon conjecture and suspicion. In recent years, however, as you will see, punitive remedies against unorthodox political ideas have been increasingly imposed on the theory that unless such preventative action is taken, the communication of such ideas will be the direct cause of acts which are wrongful of themselves. This, of course, has long been the practice of those foreign systems of law which fail to give recognition to the presumption of innocence characteristic of Anglo-American jurisprudence. Up to now, preventative actions against the communication of ideas have been taken by the government against groups, but, as yet, not against individual citizens. The Internal Security Act, whose provisions have not yet been enforced, does, however, on its face, contemplate such preventative action against individuals. If this sounds like the thought police, it is. All right, so that should ring a bell with y'all. The Attorney General's list of proscribed organizations is the best illustration of how the principle of preventative law has been applied to groups. It also shows the extent to which this principle is becoming a fixture in American law. The use and practice of the Attorney General's list of alleged subversive organizations illustrates the indirect but restrictive governmental pressure in the direction of thought control. Well, there it is. For experience demonstrates that it is extremely unlikely that any executive official would take the risk of appointing or employing anyone who had been associated with one of these groups. It may well be asked, therefore, whether in practice this list does not operate as a bill of attainder. This is particularly true of the use made of the list in the field of industrial security, where many wage earners have been discharged because of some kind of relationship at some time to one of those prescribed organizations. And let me just stop there, too. Let me go back to this because it strikes me ironically funny. What did it say? Unlikely that any executive official would take the risk of appointing or employing anyone who had ever been associated with one of these groups. All right, look. I mean, one of the things I'm talking about is during the 50s, they had James Burnham become an advisor. They had him in the CIA when he early on was a Trotskyite. Do I care? No. I'm just laughing because these are some of the supposed communist fighters of the mid-50s, and Burnham was joined by the likes of Leo Strauss and George Kennan. I don't know. It was like they were supposed to be fighting communism, but at the same time they seemed to be kind of with it. Again, I don't care. But, you know, things did not go as O'Brien thought they would, and as anybody thought would happen. Originally intended as one of the several texts to be applied, connection with one of the organizations on the list has too often become the only test. Another indirect effect is that the existence of the list discourages membership in any discussion group. Officials frequently assert that these various procedures and practices do not amount to, quote, thought control, end of quote. Yet surely, disregarding semantics, it cannot be denied that they operate to promote conformity and standardization, as well as to constrain the freedom of thought and of association on part of the individual. In now reviewing the measures adopted by our government to combat the evils of communism and of subversive activities generally, I ask you to note the consistency with which both the Congress and the executive have steadily and deliberately expanded the restrictive programs, operations, of government, and placed their conception of the need for national security ahead of the traditional rights of the individual. Over and over again, we have been warned against the insidious and sinister invasions of civil liberty by plausible excuses. Yet it is noteworthy that in our time, some of the most damaging of these encroachments have been deliberately embodied in acts of Congress. This is the chronology of the more significant developments. In 1920, Congress amended the Immigration Act by adding as a ground of deportation membership in or affiliation with any organization which fitted a certain description, essentially communism in character. In 1939, the Supreme Court held that this statute was not to be given a retroactive effect, but in 1940, Congress, by enacting the Smith Act, overruled that decision and thus specifically gave that effect to the original statute and made former membership in or sympathetic association with a prescribed group a ground for deportation. Another indication of the temper of Congress and its lack of concern for the rights of the individual was shown when the Supreme Court decided that immigration proceedings must be conducted in accordance with the Act regulating administrative procedures, whereupon Congress immediately passed a statute exempting immigration hearings from the protection of that statute. The Smith Act of 1940 made it unlawful for any person to be or to become a member of our affiliate with any society, group, or assembly which teaches, advocates, or encourages the overthrow or destruction of any government in the United States by force or violence. Of any government in the United States? Are there more than one? All right. These statutes, therefore, imported into our law the alien doctrine of guilt by association, which up to this time had been regarded as abhorrent and which had never been recognized either by the courts or by the Department of Justice, even during the perils and excitements of the First World War. President Truman, on March 21, 1947, promulgated the first loyalty order making government employees subject to dismissal for disloyalty. The declared purpose of this order was to eliminate communists and spies from government employment. 3 years later, however, the chairman of the Loyalty Review Board reported to Congress that not a single instance of espionage or sabotage had been discovered in any of the hundreds of cases presented. The standard of disqualification prescribed in that order was, quote, reasonable grounds for belief that the person involved is disloyal, end of quotes. The requirement of this finding obviously imposed a serious burden of responsibility upon the reviewing boards, and in 1950, at their request, the order was amended to make the standard of disqualification, quote, reasonable doubt, end of quote, as to an employer's loyalty. This alteration, largely unnoticed at the time, shifted to the accused employee the burden of proof of establishing his loyalty and integrity beyond a reasonable doubt. In 1950, Congress enacted, over the President's veto, the so-called Internal Security Act. Its outstanding features were requirements for the registration and regulation of communist organizations, and also a provision conferring upon the President, acting through the Attorney General, power to detain in time of national emergency any, quote, person, And in parentheses, it says, presumably citizen as well as alien, concerning whom, quote, there is reasonable ground to believe that such person probably will engage in or probably will conspire with others to engage in acts of espionage or of sabotage. All right, and there's a footnote here. Internal Security Act of 1950, Section 103A. The power to seize and imprison an alien enemy during wartime has been recognized since 1798, but this is the first time in our history that Congress has attempted to authorize imprisonment of a citizen because of suspected intentions, just because we think you might. Holy mackerel. All right. Although this statute provides for a kind of judicial review, on its face, permits the accused to cross-examine witnesses and introduce evidence. It contains the fatal limitation that the Attorney General shall not be required to disclose to the accused information the revelation of which would disclose the identity of government agents or officers which he believes it would be dangerous to national safety and security to divulge. Now, you see what the problem with this is? You're allowed to do cross-examination, and but not all of them. So, in other words, it's like you can, but we can withhold or deny that request. So you have no request at all, just the color of a request. And here we go. Okay, I hate this word, and you'll find out why. Similarly, upon court review, the Attorney General is required to present the evidence supporting the finding of reasonable ground for detention, quote, only to an extent consistent with national security, end of quote. Well, what exactly is that? All right. This statute also provides for the establishment of concentration camps designated as, quote, detention camps, unquote. It is officially reported that several of these camps have already been completed and are ready for occupancy. In 1954, additional statutes were enacted outlawing the Communist Party, prohibiting its members from serving as officers of labor unions or in other representative capacities, and generally speaking, strengthening and making more rigid the requirements of the previous statutes relating to this general subject, including espionage and sabotage. Partly because of the stigma resulting from the enforcement of the original loyalty order, President Eisenhower in 1953 substituted for it an executive order which established the so-called Federal Security Program, setting up certain broad standards to determine whether the employment of an applicant for government service or the continuance of a government employee in service would, quote, be clearly consistent with the national security, end of quote. In practice, many administrators interpret this to mean that any doubtful case must be decided in favor of the government. The access of the security boards secret derogatory information denied to the accused obviously intensifies the handicap under which he labors. This catalog of statutes and executive orders is only part of the picture. It is in the procedures established for the enforcement of these statutes and orders that the most serious questions are arising affecting individual freedom and the present political status of the citizen in the American polity. There's a footnote here as well, coming from M.S. Livingston, Science and Security, American Academy of Political and Social Science, 1955. Here's the quote. But the most controversial result is the considerable variation in procedures used in the several agencies. There is no general standard to provide an objective basis of judgment and no criteria for determining the degree of risk suggested by an individual's background. Some agencies allowed hearings before action is taken. Others use summary suspension on unevaluated derogatory information, regardless of the damage to the laboratory program or to the individual. Go figure that one out. All right, the first outstanding fact of importance presented by this chronological history is that, for the first time, administrative, parentheses, and not judicial, officials and agencies have been authorized to inquire into and pass judgment upon the personal beliefs, associations, and opinions of a private citizen employed or seeking employment in the government service. This practice, in itself, is a grave departure from traditional constitutional procedures and it impinges it directly upon the constitutional guarantees of the citizen, by the way, of which you have none, and that for another time. The more startling invasion of the citizen's traditional rights, however, results from the methods and procedures adopted by the administrative agencies in carrying out these programs. And here we have another footnote. Not sure where that comes from, but here it is. The creation of administrative commissions and agencies was originally justified by the assertion that the members would possess a certain expertise in dealing with business and economic problems. But there is no expertise in the field of ideas. This is an excellent illustration of the way in which principles and procedures applicable to the regulation of property rights are thoughtlessly and by some false analogy extended to impose limitations on human liberty. Back to O'Brien. The Supreme Court, by a narrow majority, has ruled that these security hearings, which involve the good name and the reputation of the individual and his fitness for government employment, are merely hiring inquiries and are not trials within the constitutional sense. The court has therefore ruled in these cases that, because adverse rulings involve no loss of property or liberty, in parentheses, despite the damage beyond measure which may be inflicted on the individual by adverse rulings either as to loyalty or security, end of parentheses, the individual involved is not entitled to the due process of law guaranteed by the Bill of Rights. And I will tell you that that is fair game, too, because we are not party to the Bill of Rights, and that for another time. The import of the court's ruling is enhanced by the fact that the tribunal which makes the decision regarding employment is not a judicial tribunal, but an administrative panel frequently comprised of persons having no particular competence and no special knowledge of the limits or even the importance of constitutional privileges. Another conspicuous weakness in the system is a lack of standards by which to measure the qualifications of security officers as well as of panel members. Another footnote from Livingston, Science and Security. The security officer who prepared the sensational charges at Fort Monmouth rose to his position of responsibility from earlier jobs as a chauffeur and a uniformed plant guard. Fort Monmouth, I have no idea. I got to look into that one. Sufficient attention has not been given to the implications of the Supreme Court's decision. There have been strong protests against this ruling by various members of the judiciary as well as by publicists. And another footnote. This from Justice William O. Douglas, addressed to American Law Institute, May 20th, 1953. And Willie had this to say. Who is there who does not cherish his reputation, his professional status, his honor as much as life itself? Thank you for that, Willie. Those who protest insist that the court must take cognizance of the fact that a proceeding of this kind, whether it be called a hearing or a trial, which ends in an adverse ruling, in effect adjudges the person involved to be unworthy of trust and therefore unfit for employment. Experience demonstrates that an adverse ruling definitely handicaps the accused in obtaining employment elsewhere. The mere fact that it is thought necessary to hold a hearing shows there is a derogatory information sufficiently serious to require an answer. In short, the individual becomes the accused, and there is no presumption of innocence to protect him. Critics insist that the courts, in depriving the person involved of due process of law, have taken a strict and technical view of the liberty of the citizen, wholly at variance with the spirit of the Constitution. And I'm going to say this once again, and we'll get into this later if you haven't come across it before. We have no constitutional protection. All right? Later on. Going back to O'Brien. In one of his last addresses, Mr. Justice Jackson protested against this attitude in the following language. And here's block quotes from Jackson. We believe it is a duty to champion all fundamental rights under the law, but we recognize a special trust and competence to safeguard every man's right to fair trial on which every other right is dependent. We cannot approve any use of official powers or position to prejudice, injure, or condemn a person in liberty, property, or good name, which does not conform him of the source and substance of the charge, and give a timely and open-minded hearing as to its truth, safeguards without which no judgment can have a sound foundation. And that is once again from Jackson's The Task of Maintaining Our Liberties, The Role of the Judiciary, from the American Bar Association Journal, November 1953. Furthermore, the current hearing procedures cannot be justified by the cliché that no one has a legal right to work for the government, even conceding, arguendo, that in some cases an administrator should have power to dismiss arbitrarily. This does not justify dismissal without a fair hearing for a cause which imputes disgrace, lack of honor, loss of reputation, or lack of patriotism on the part of the person dismissed. In the trend of events thus set in motion, a number of other procedural processes have been established, which until recently have been denounced as foreign to the American conception of freedom. First and foremost is the use as evidence of secret information from anonymous informants regarding whose reliability or competence even the hearing officers have no information. This in turn results in the denial of the right of cross-examination, which is the most powerful and most sacred of all rights for the protection of the individual. Third, this same practice has given rise to the use by government officials of agents provocateurs and paid informants whose evidence is usually taken from the secret dossiers kept by various intelligence services. In actuality, this danger has assumed even larger proportions, for, in the several cases in which the point was raised, the Attorney General has refused to permit even the hearing officers to see the anonymous informers. In at least one important case, the Attorney General has refused to disclose to a United States District Judge in camera the reasons for which he took official action. Again, a footnote. That was from Shaughnessy v. Metzi, 354 U.S. 206. The excuse put forward for the alien practices we have mentioned is that disclosure of the identity of secret witnesses would hamper the prosecution in obtaining evidence. Another footnote, again from Douglas, addressed to the American Law Institute, May 20, 1953. Douglas states, "That is always the justification of the police. That, I submit, is a philosophy repellent to our traditions. But I speak, I think, the conscience of the law when I say the practice should be condemned." From this, it necessarily follows that the constitutional freedom of the individual is subordinated to the ease of prosecution. Regardless of whether these practices are justifiable or not, from the standard of expediency, it seems undeniable that they inevitably impair the constitutional presumption of innocence. Recently, a new danger to personal liberty has arisen in this field by reason of the expansion of the security program into those plants in private industry where work is being performed on government contracts. Primarily intended for the protection of classified information, these inquisitions have been extended to include, in some instances, jobs having no contact with classified material. The spectacle is thus presented of anonymous military officials conducting inquiries into the character, associations, and opinions of the wage earner, inquiries which frequently result in depriving him of his job. This infiltration of military power into the most sensitive areas of private employment is new, and its full import has not yet been realized. And a footnote. Wage earners who fall within this category are presented with a questionnaire, including a copy of the Attorney General's list of alleged subversive organizations. The questionnaire requires the employee to answer at the risk of criminal penalties for misrepresentation, questions as to possible activities by him in connection with any of these organizations. The extent to which the web of security regulations interferes with the freedom of the individual and deprives a nation of the services of competent and even great scientists and other experts is not fully appreciated. Immigration officials have administered their powers so arbitrarily that many foreign scientists and other specialists cannot enter this country and are compelled to seek freedom for conferences in Canada or Mexico. The same officials deny some American citizens permission to leave this country, and travel privileges are frequently restricted. The effects upon public servants in the diplomatic service are too well known to require comment. One other illustration of restraint practically unknown to the general public is the power of life and death wielded by officers of the Coast Guard in determining the right of a common seaman to secure employment. This appears to be the strictest of all the restraints imposed by the federal government upon the freedom of the individual. No seaman, longshoreman, or other person may have access to United States ships or restricted waterfront areas without clearance by the Office of the Commandant of the Coast Guard at Washington. To secure clearance, the seaman must make application to the local office of the Coast Guard, which then transfers the application to Washington, where all secret government files are checked for derogatory information regarding the applicant. Information from these files is the sole ground for the ruling of the commandant, who, unless he is, quote, satisfied, end of quote, as to the, quote, character and habits of life of the applicant, end of quote, denies the clearance. The applicant, who is refused clearance, however, may appear before a review board and present evidence, but is not required that he be informed of the charges against him. If he fails to convince this appellate board, he may appeal and appear before a higher board in Washington. But once this agency has ruled against him, he is permanently barred from his former vocation. This program directly affects the right to work of approximately 500,000 seamen. Unfortunately, the scope of our discussion prevents our going into the extent to which adverse rulings have excluded large numbers of seamen from their customary employment. This strange procedure is another illustration of the continual expansion of regulations aimed to prevent sabotage and espionage and the spread of subversive ideas. Once the totalitarian principle is accepted that the government must prevent the spread of ideas thought to be subversive, it is perhaps logical to have an anonymous official in the Post Office Department to prevent the delivery by mail of Soviet newspapers or books to American scholars. If anonymous military officials are given authority to decide who shall work in private industry in a defense plant, it is not far-fetched for them to demand the right to scrutinize the subject matter of educational curriculums in colleges which are doing research work of a classified nature under military contracts. There are at present no less than 200 educational institutions engaged in such work. Harvey was not one of them. These far-flung regulations illustrate again the truth that once the power is given to government officials to inquire into the associations and opinions of private individuals, there is literally no limit to the expansion of inquisitions and the injustice which must inevitably result. How the courts will rule upon the application of the Due Process Clause to these proceedings affecting men employed in private industry is at present an open question. Doubts as to the justification for these practices are not lessened, but rather increased by the fact that the great majority of the persons accused are eventually cleared by the hearing boards. It is important to notice that the issues raised by the orders of the President are no more serious than certain policies deliberately embodied in recent legislation by the Congress. I repeat, the all-important fact is that all these programs and policies embody a definite and consistent trend in government policy which, on the surface at least, and in many respects, is in conflict with our traditional standards of justice and also with ancient liberties guaranteed to the citizen. All right, that ends the first half of the speech that O'Brien gave at Harvard, the overall title being National Security and Individual Freedom. And you heard the first part, which was on day one, entitled Security in an Age of Anxiety. Now, what I'm pleading with you folks to countenance is that you see what happened back in the 50s and how it's with us again. And the point is that if we're the country we say we are, we must keep certain things in place. But now, since 9/11, every time, I guess, there's any reason to believe by the government that the knaves are getting restless. They throw out the terror factor. In this case, it's not the communists. That's long since gone, although all this talk about Putin and such, which is just nothing but garbage. All right, now it's a radical Muslim provocateurs. That's the new terrorism wave. But the point is this. The reaction by the people is what's used to go ahead and justify whatever further abridgments of freedom we have left. But despite the fact that we were told to, I guess, give some support to this foreign intrigue we've been on since 2001, is that we're safer here because the soldiers are fighting over there. But neither are we safer, nor do we have them, the liberties we once had. And the problem is this, is that that attitude about strike whatever you have to in order to keep us safe leaves you with very little. And it was best stated in a movie based on a play by Robert Bolt entitled A Man for All Seasons. It is about Thomas More facing off with King Henry VIII about certain issues. And in this particular scene, which is from the movie A Man for All Seasons, there is an ancient provocateur from Henry's camp who's a worm, Richie Rich, whatever, who comes to talk to More in the presence of his family, his wife, his daughter, and his daughter's fiancé, who's a firebrand. And everybody knows he's a stinker, and More knows he's a stinker. But after he leaves, this is what ensues. Listen to the mentality at that table, because that is exactly what's happening here now.
Arrest him.
For what?
He's dangerous.
For libel. He's a spy.
Father, that man's bad.
There's no law against that.
There is God's law.
Then God can arrest him.
While you talk, he's gone.
And go he should if he were the devil himself until he broke the law.
So, now you give the devil benefit of the law.
Yes, what would you do? Cut a great road through the law to get after the devil?
Yes. I'd cut down every law in England to do that.
Oh? And when the last law was down and the devil turned round on you, where would you hide, Roper? The law's all being flat. This country is planted thick with laws from coast to coast. Man's laws, not God's. And if you cut them down, and you're just a man to do it, do you really think you could stand upright in the winds that would blow then? Yes. I give the devil benefit of law for my own safety's sake.
So what's happening here is, your government really doesn't have to go on the forefront of abridging your freedoms, however many there are left, which is still probably better than what most of this earth's countries have. But they're going to let you do it for them. You're going to beg for it. And they will give it to you. You know, it's the same thing, too, with this whole situation with privacy and the right to have such. People now are just giving it away. I mean, there was a time when you would never talk about your junk, even on a payphone. I mean, if somebody was over your shoulder, you'd like give them the dagger look and they'd back away like five city blocks. But now people just slap the cell phone to their ear. They talk about everything. You know, and first of all, I don't really want to hear your junk. And yet they have no problem with it whatsoever. And with regard to the warning by Justice Brandeis that the right to be left alone by the government is the most comprehensive of rights and the right most valued by civilized man. Well, that's dissipating faster than spring snow. And yet nobody really cares. People put stuff on Facebook and all these other things, and all they ever do is get themselves in trouble. They're like a little bunch of chimpanzees. And why? First of all, who cares about your stuff? Who are you to think anybody else cares about your stuff? But everybody just can't wait to gush it all out on the internet. And that's going to come back to haunt you, without a doubt. But again, here's the thing. If you don't value privacy, then nothing really matters. You're already conditioned to have yourself scrutinized day in and day out. And that's where we're going. I mean, one of the, I guess, most benign parts of totalitarianism is that you're scrutinized fully, top to bottom, day and night. Now, if you don't mind somebody just checking you out at any point in time, I guess that's not really a problem. Although, I think it will be a problem over the course of time. And by then, you can't do anything about it because the trap has already been sprung. So it just amazes me that people can just put everything out there and not even give a thought that is this a good thing? I think not. The other thing also is this. To keep America fighting, which arguably, like I said, has been the case since the 1890s, you gotta have bad guys. Always have to have bad guys. It's gotta be the new villain, the new Emmanuel Goldstein. Something to hate so that you can get behind the military, which is the government, whenever it wants to go off on another intrigue. It's told us that, well, you know, it's to protect us, but is it really? All right, that's it for this first half of the two-day speech. We'll get into the second half called Security, Sanity, and Fair Play next time around.
I've been in this town so long and back in the city. I've been taken for lost and gone and unknown for a long, long time. Fell in love years ago with an innocent girl from the Spanish and Indian home, full of the heroes and
understand is that it's better to die on your feet than to live on your knees.
You have it backwards. It's better to live on your feet than to die on your knees. I know.
How do you know?
Because I'm 107 years old. How old are you?
I'll be 20 in January.
If you're late.
I've been in this town so long, so long to the city. I'm fit with the stuff to ride in the rough, and sunny down snuff, I'm all right.
This program is produced by Visigoth Incorporated. Any rebroadcast or use of this program without the express consent of Visigoth Incorporated is strictly encouraged. I'm Phil McCracken, the voice behind the voice, and thank you for listening.